This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We're just a few days away from a new administration in Washington, D.C., and as we anticipate what that might mean for education in the U.S. in the coming months and years, there's another question some educators are facing. How will we teach the history of this election?
There's a good chance that what we've seen as defining our politics over the last, say, 40, 50, 60 years could become more history and less contemporary.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk again with Dr. Adam Carrington, an assistant professor of politics, and not only put the election in historic perspective, but try and speculate on how history will talk about our choices. Then we'll learn why a large number of military families are choosing homeschooling for their kids. And we'll spend an academic minute trying to save our souls. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There will be countless books written about the 2016 election. It's an election where everything we thought we knew about politics and what will and won't work in a political campaign was not only proven wrong, it was proven ridiculously wrong. To take a look back at this historic election season and a look ahead on how future political scholars might try to explain it, let's welcome back Dr. Adam Carrington. Dr. Carrington is an assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. We spoke about the election back in October, so I wanted to check in again and see what he thought about the way things turned out. Our conversation started like this. So, professor of politics, what do you do with all those books now? Do you just throw them out the window and start over?
Well, one thing that does seem to be the case is there are, I think, some historical precedents for at least some of the things behind the 2016 election. Many people are comparing Trump to, say, Andrew Jackson, who led a more populist and nationalistic campaign in the 1820s and 30s, and Teddy Roosevelt, who had, you know, a program called the New Nationalism in the early 1900s. So I think what's going to get thrown out is not so much all of the books on American history and American politics, but certainly there's a good chance that what we've seen as defining our politics over the last, say, 40, 50, 60 years, say, since the 1960s or even 50s, those are now going to be, could become more history and less contemporary.
It seems like a lot of the norms we see during presidential elections and regulations came out of Watergate.
Certainly, that's been the last massive reform of ethics on the presidential level since the 1970s. That was really the last big one that changed the paradigm in that way.
So things that happened since then is every candidate has released their taxes since then. That didn't happen this year. It's just so many things that you say, well, this has to happen, and if it doesn't, there's just no way that candidate can win.
Yes, and some of it is both ways. I mean, if you have one candidate who seemed for a time to be under serious investigation by the FBI, you would say that person would have very difficult chance of winning because of how hard they'd get hit by the other candidate. But then when you realize the other candidate has had a whole series of ethical and verbal and other problems, you would say that person too. So, you know, it's been said that both candidates sort of needed each other, given, I think, the circumstances. And both had serious, serious gaps where you definitely saw a number of people voting against, not for, which always happens, but the strength of that certainly seemed to be more intense in many areas. And so I think that's where somehow the rules didn't necessarily apply because the rules assume that both candidates aren't in as much trouble as far as their perception and public image.
Thinking back, President Trump will be the first president since Eisenhower that had no political experience. Is that right?
Yes. He will, and typically that has been reserved for generals in the past, where whether you have, you know, Ulysses S. Grant or, as you said, Dwight Eisenhower. The transfer from general to president has been looked on positively in several cases by Americans. This is interestingly where the transfer from businessman to president has been for the first time really approved. And so that will be an interesting thing to see how does that skill set correlate and translate or not.
That hasn't happened before, has it? Someone from business going right to the presidency?
No, it is not. I mean, certainly you've had people who have run businesses, then gone on to be senators, governors, house members. secretaries of state, things like that. But this kind of direct move has not been. And actually, you know, this we did see an example of this being tried one other time with Ross Perot. And some of the same arguments made for Perot have been made for Trump, that as a businessman, he'll know how to manage government. He'll know how to manage a lot of different moving parts. But it is true that we've not actually seen that occur and seen whether we're really comparing anything close to apples to apples. So, again, politics is going to be fascinating in the next few years, and that's just one of many different angles you could take to see why.
Take a look inside a politics classroom 20 years from now. How are they going to be talking about this election?
Oh, destroy this tape after you run the interview. no, I that is a great question, and I think it depends in part upon whether Donald Trump is able to form something like a movement around himself or not, and whether it would be lasting and whether it would not be driven by personality. Of course, some of what he's done is driven by personality, but certainly not all. Certainly there were the seeds before for this. Because, you know, 8 years ago, we were talking about this being the age of President Obama. So I would say, in 20 years, we'll either be talking about this as a blip in a rising, more Obama-era politics, or we'll see that Trump sort of recast the paradigm of what it means to be conservative or liberal or Democrat or Republican in a way that whether he's successful in winning future elections certainly changed how we view what's important in politics.
Look back a little bit at 2010 when the Tea Party movement really started gaining momentum. Is there something comparable in history to that?
It is comparable to have something, what you might call a populist movement, sort of a declaration that the difference isn't on issues that we are often thinking of left versus right, but of what are sort of city versus country, or you could say, you know, some of the language being thrown out is elites versus the common man, is at least the language that's being used. And you see that. You saw that in with Jackson, Andrew Jackson, in the past, where he was very much a man of the people and seen as a vulgarian by others that opposed him. You see this with the agrarian movement in the Democratic Party in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So there is an example of that. I will say, at least in the modern era, the idea of a more conservative populism is a little more closer to something unique. Typically, it's been more left-leaning. Although, to be honest, I mean, given the paradigms that President Trump is attempting to set up, this kind of populism is not going to look exactly like the conservatism as has been defined since, say, Ronald Reagan or William F. Buckley.
What else can you say about this? It certainly was fun to watch as it was going along. As a teacher of politics, it was quite a ride.
Absolutely. It was fascinating, and it sort of building off something I said in the last question, it is interesting to ask what will be the new paradigms on sort of two levels. One will be the paradigm as far as public discourse. What does civility mean, and what does free speech mean? And how are we going to balance those two going forward? But then the other is, what will be the issues defining us? I think really for the last 50, 60 years, we've been fighting predominantly oversimplified it, of course, but we've been fighting over the size and scope of government, what should government be doing at all, and then the location of government, where should those things be occurring, and even social and economic issues, I think, can both be categorized that way. We may be moving away from that. We may be moving more toward sort of cosmopolitanism, or it's sometimes called globalism more negatively, which looks at diversity and looks at free trade and things like that as good things, versus a more nationalistic view that isn't as concerned about the size of government, but who is government benefiting? The common man, homogeneously understood Americans, or others? And I think that's where it can be really fascinating, too, if the politics as we've understood it for the last 50, 60 years all of a sudden becomes obsolete in even what are the dividing issues, where all of a sudden states that we thought were safe become toss-ups, voting groups that we thought were toss-ups become safe for one or the other. I think all of that, as far as what I would say in 20 years, all of that could come into play.
Well, just going over the past 16 years, two of the last five presidential elections were split, popular vote and electoral vote. And didn't that only happen twice before in the entire republic, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been very rare. Really, it is the Electoral College is set up to mostly parallel the popular vote, but not completely. And I think it really does show that we've got a very divided country that has not definitively decided between really more than two competing visions of where we want to move forward, what we want to do. And I think that the fact that you had such a huge split between the Electoral College and the popular vote just goes to show that that's part of the problem going forward. Is this is the beginning of an argument, not the end of an argument. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out going forward.
Every time we have an election like this, well, every time we have a result, people talk about the losing party as such and such party is dead. They talked about the Republicans 8 years ago. They talk about the Democrats now. Will we ever get a party just go out of business and like the Whigs and get a new one?
I think that's very possible. I mean, of course, you point to one of the great examples, the Whigs. It happened with the Federalists, which was George Washington and Alexander Hamilton's party after the 1800 election. It is quite possible. The way it would happen would be for one or both parties to so fundamentally refuse to adapt to or placate or at least anticipate and react to changes in politics, whether it be changes in what the voters want, changes in the massive issues before us, that it basically implodes on itself. I don't see that happening yet at all. I think as Mark Twain said, I think famously, to the effect that the statements about his death had been grossly overstated, right? And I think that's true with the Democratic Party too. They want a majority of the popular vote, even though that actually in the end isn't the way we select a president. But it means they have a great base too. If an interesting thing to note is, if about 81,000-82,000 votes shifted in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan combined, we're talking Hillary Clinton, President of the United States. That just shows that this was a very close election and that both parties have strong bases to build off of, and it's not clear that they'll fall apart yet, but you're absolutely right. History repeats itself, and that's very possible, but I just don't see it immediately happening.
I see the biggest loser in this election is the polling industry. They got everything wrong.
I'll say, I think we've been a little hard on the pollsters when we should be a little harder on the prognosticators rather than on the pollsters. And let me explain, let me say real quickly what I mean by the differences. You know, the polls had Hillary Clinton winning the popular vote. If you average them all out, now of course they're outliers, had her winning the popular vote by about 3.5 points. She ended up winning by 2.1. That's not a terrible miss. I think one of the biggest problems was seeing that how weak she was in the Electoral College and not taking it seriously. When, you know, Nate Silver and those, you know, he definitely gave Trump a better chance than others. But if you look at, say, the New York Times and some of the others who basically gave Trump a 1% chance of winning, I think that was taking poll numbers that showed Hillary with an advantage but within the margin of error, and were unwilling to understand that margin of error means, you know, the other person could win. And so I think there was a failure to understand that there were a lot of people out there who really were honestly going to vote for Trump, and not being willing to look at the polling data in an honest way.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I still say the biggest winner of the night was Mitch McConnell. He got everything he wanted.
That it'll depend upon how well he can work with Donald Trump. He got the presidency, the Senate, the House. Now the question is, will he get his agenda? And that is going to be the test, because Trump certainly came in by being a bull in the China shop of Republican orthodoxies. So the question is, how much of his agenda will he get through, and how much is Mitch McConnell more interested in just having the power? And that's going to be the question. He certainly got everything he wanted electorally. Will that translate into an agenda? And I think it remains to be seen, but that time will tell come January 20th.
Well, I think he took a huge gamble with the Merrick Garland nomination, and it paid off.
Oh, that's true. That's true. On that particular point, he took a very bold gamble, and I think you're absolutely right that paid off handsomely when many people were trying to tell him that that was foolish, that it would just look like obstructionist, that it would cost them votes in November. And no, you're absolutely right. On the Supreme Court, he took a gamble that paid off, and boldness paid off in that instance.
Well, you know what? I'm going to end this with me being absolutely right.
Okay. You're better than me. I normally don't quit when I'm ahead.
Dr. Adam Carrington is an assistant professor of politics at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. Still to come, many military families are making their children's education an in-home project. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. As schools around the country reopen after winter break, a small but growing number of children will not be there. Homeschooling is becoming much more common among military families. Reporter Patricia Murphy looked into the reasons why.
It's the middle of the school day for the Owen children, but you won't find them in a classroom. Six of the seven Owen kids are at Sunnyside Beach in Washington State with their mom, Becky.
Zoe, you can make a dream catcher.
While 4-year-old Zoe and 6-year-old Joshua look for feathers, 15-year-old Hannah was dreading her next task.
I'm not going to make dream catchers. I got to do like boring stuff like memorize parts of the Constitution.
The Owens are being homeschooled, and this beach trip is part of today's curriculum. They're a military family. Becky Owen's husband joined the Army in 2005, and she says it made sense to homeschool her children because the family moved around so much.
Our first duty station was Germany. But even before we got there, you know, he had basic training, and then he had the other training, and so we just kept homeschooling through all of this because it gave us the flexibility we needed. Other, my kids would have had to be in and out of schools 3 times before Germany.
A decade after their stint in Germany, the 6 school-age children are still learning at home in DuPont, Washington, near where their dad is stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. 18-year-old Deborah says it's been a great experience for her.
Instead of being caught up with all the tests and all the grades and all the stuff that stresses out all of my peers, I've been able to focus on what I really care about and want to pursue.
The Owens are among what seems to be a growing trend. Homeschooling is becoming more popular among the population as a whole. And while the Department of Defense doesn't track the number of homeschoolers, a study conducted for the Army suggested military families are more likely to homeschool than civilian families are. Tom Halverson of the University of Washington College of Education says the nomadic life of military families is one of the biggest reasons they homeschool. Military kids move an average of 9 times before age 17.
That could be a very challenging and chaotic situation for kids, completely jumping into new situations, new classrooms, new students, new teachers, new surroundings. And so a homeschooling situation where students could have that consistency, I think, could be a real advantage.
Like homeschoolers in general, some military parents also want to give their children a religious education or pursue their own curriculum. But Halverson says homeschooling isn't right for everyone.
Especially for older kids, I think that's where you would start to run into a real challenge for parents, is trying to be able to devote enough time to be able to stay ahead of the kids and really provide a balanced instruction for them through some of those tougher subjects.
That's a lesson that Jen Stahl learned when she was homeschooled in the 1990s as her family traveled the world with her Navy dad. She now lives with her husband and two kids in Germany and belongs to a group that advocates for tougher homeschooling oversight. When we talked with her on Skype, she recalled the strong military influence of her homeschool education.
It was boot camp, basically, at home. I actually would joke with people and say, you know, the only reason I didn't enlist is because I've already done boot camp.
Even Becky Owen, an enthusiastic homeschooler, ended up putting one of her daughters in a school run by the U.S. Department of Defense in Germany. It happened when her six-year-old was having trouble reading.
It wasn't clicking for her. She was very stubborn. She thought only dad could teach her how to read, and then dad was being deployed. And so we had her tested, and it turns out that she had visual tracking issues. And she would go every day for reading lessons or reading class.
Like the rest of the Owen children, though, Hannah eventually went back to full-time homeschooling. And Becky Owen says although every one of her children is different, the family figured out what learning style works for each of them. The Department of Defense says it neither encourages nor discourages homeschooling among military families, and it has no data to compare the academic achievement of military homeschooled children to other kids. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
We all got body, but do we really have soul? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
You've got body and soul. Or do you? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Rafael Narvaez, associate professor of sociology at Winona State University, explores the question of souls and our reality.
Do we have a soul? Is it material like air or immaterial like a shadow? Are souls feminine and masculine, or do they remove their gender as they exit the body? If souls resemble the body, can they be, say, blue-eyed or blind or white or black? Are there infant souls in the afterworld? Do they grow up? When we sleep, does the soul leave the body to enter into another worldly order that we experience as a dream? Can it be trapped there to be sold in the black market? Where does it go after death? To the bush, the domain of spirits? To the underworld, where it loses its memory? Is there a place reserved for the souls of soldiers and one for those of philosophers? Can the soul be tortured? Are stars souls? Is the soul a bird? Questions and beliefs like this have marked people's identities, influenced how we see others, and how we divide the world. Spanish colonists, for instance, often thought that Indians did not have a soul, which partly explains the savagery of the colonial process. In the West, a body-soul rhetoric has evolved along with features of our civilization, a process that has marked, in particular, the humanities and the arts. Why is medieval plainchant, for example, devoid of beat? Because beat, the clergy argued, leaps to the feet and to the hip to thus pollute the soul. Changes in beliefs about the soul have also marked how we perceive reality and even how we experience the body. Consider sexuality, for instance. An embodied experience historically regarded as a threat to the soul. The world has seen age-old battles for the control of this body-soul rhetoric, battles that are still waged today need our attention because they ultimately are about the social construction of reality and of features of civilization itself.
That was Rafael Narvaez of Winona State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.